And right here in San Francisco, we have some traffic issues. Here's Mel Baker.
Northbound 101 from 3rd Street all the way up to the 10180 interchange is stop and go. 101 is backed up to eastbound 80 at 7th Street, where a stalled dump truck is blocking the right lane on the Bay Bridge. Just after Treasure Island in the westbound direction, a stalled car in the second lane from the left. It's stop and go back to the incline. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED on Wednesday morning comes from Save the Bay, imagining a Bay Area where people and wildlife thrive. The future is possible. Turn the tide and rise to the climate challenge. More at SaveSFBayNow.org. Along the coast today, a beach hazard statement for high surf. Bay Area highs from the coast, 70s all the way up to the low 100s. Well, inland, it starts to cool off tomorrow. Good morning, I'm Dave Freeman at 8 o'clock on KQED-FM San Francisco and KQEI-FM North Highlands, Sacramento.
Good morning. President Biden took executive action to curb the number of asylum seekers entering the country. We'll ask Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas about why now on this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, officers have removed pro-Palestinian activists from the office of Stanford's president.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi won a third consecutive term. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin, but his BJP party failed to secure an outright majority in the parliament. What does this mean for Modi and his policies? Plus, educators are alarmed by how many students in the U.S. are missing from class, one of the grades most affected, kindergarten. It is Wednesday, June 5th. On this day in 1975, Egypt reopened the Suez Canal to international shipping 8 years after it was closed because of the 1967 war with Israel. And the news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Boeing space capsule, the Starliner, has lifted off a few minutes ago from Cape Canaveral in Florida. Two astronauts are aboard. They're headed for the International Space Station. They should reach orbit in a few minutes. Israel's military has launched a new offensive in central Gaza as the U.S. is urging a Gaza ceasefire. A Gaza hospital director tells NPR its facility received at least 78 people who were killed in the latest offensive in an area where many displaced Palestinians are sheltering. Israel is also threatening a new military campaign in Lebanon, as NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
The Israeli army says its latest offensive is targeting militant infrastructure in the Burej refugee camp and eastern Deir el-Balah. Those are areas in central Gaza where the Israeli army operated earlier in the war. The Biden administration is calling for the war to end. President Biden announced last week that Israel had proposed a ceasefire deal, and U.S. officials say they're waiting for Hamas's official reply. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited the northern border near Lebanon, where Hezbollah has stepped up its rocket fire in recent weeks. Israel's army chief says Israel must soon decide whether to launch an offensive in Lebanon. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The U.S. Senate is poised to vote on a bill that protects the right to contraception. NPR's Barbara Sprunt says the legislation comes ahead of an important anniversary.
Well, this comes just ahead of the second anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court striking down federal abortion protections. And since then, voters have backed abortion rights at the ballot box in at least 6 states. So, yes, this is a messaging bill. It's exactly the message that Democrats are trying to hammer home in an election year.
NPR's Barbara Sprunt reporting. Abortion rights amendments could be on the ballot in as many as 10 states this fall. Republican members of Congress are calling for high-level resignations at the Department of Veterans Affairs. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports the VA is clawing back huge bonuses that were paid in error.
2 years ago, President Biden signed the PACT Act, a massive expansion of VA benefits for vets made sick by toxic exposures like burn pits in Afghanistan or Agent Orange in Vietnam. The bill included $11 million in salary bumps intended to keep certain VA staff from getting hired away into better-paying jobs. But nearly 200 senior staffers who did not qualify also got huge bonuses. VA Secretary Dennis McDonough informed Congress last fall of the mistake, and he says now 92% of these bonuses have been clawed back by the VA. But at a House Veterans Affairs Committee hearing, several Republicans demanded the resignations of senior officials who oversaw the bonuses. One even called for Secretary McDonough's resignation. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
On Wall Street, stocks are mixed. The Dow is down 50 points. The Nasdaq is up nearly 200. This is NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Good morning. Santa Clara County Sheriff's officials say law enforcement officers have detained a dozen pro-Palestinian activists who barricaded themselves inside the office of Stanford's president this morning. A representative for the group, Stanford for Palestine, says about 40 minutes ago, sheriff's deputies broke into the office 2 hours after their protest began. The protesters are calling for Stanford's Board of Trustees to consider a proposal to divest from companies tied to Israel's military assault on Gaza, and they want the school's president to support the bill. A Stanford representative describes the actions of the activists as unlawful. California prisons say they'll stop using a debunked program that claims to detect if someone is lying. That's after an investigation by The Chronicle. Peer-reviewed studies have found the Computer Voice Stress Analyzer, or CVSA, is no better than flipping a coin at predicting if someone is being deceptive. But more than a dozen law enforcement agencies in California use it, according to reporter Susie Nielsen.
Most agencies we spoke with wouldn't give us more information about how they use it. We spoke with three departments in California who had confirmed that they used the technology in criminal investigations. And when we pressed further, they said that they didn't remember which criminal cases they used them in or refused to give additional details.
That was The Chronicle's Susie Nielsen. And I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support for NPR this morning comes from TimberTech with the Reserve, Legacy, and Terrain deck collections, all made of recycled materials for sustainability. More at TimberTech.com. Everything wood should be. And the listeners of KQED. Mel with traffic right now on Wednesday morning at 8:06.
In Santa Rosa, 12 westbound at Merced Avenue, a dump truck and pickup truck crash has traffic backed up to Fulton Road. On 101 south northbound before Golf Course Drive in Rohnert Park, it's stop and go back to the Rohnert Park Expressway where we have a car and truck accident. Moved to the shoulder, but emergency crews there. 101 northbound between Todd Road and College Avenue, that remains slow. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. KQED News with Brian Watt coming up at 8:22. Health officials detected bird flu and a live bird market in San Francisco last month, but researchers who study wastewater have reason to believe it hasn't spread. Get informed. We'll have more for you at 8:22 from KQED News. For the Sacramento Valley, excessive heat warning in effect until Thursday evening. Hot today, to say the least. Temperatures will range from 100 to maybe 105 in the Sacramento Valley. Clear tonight, lows 62 to 72. Highs tomorrow, 95 to 105 degrees. Bay Area, look for heavy surf today. A beach hazard statement issued along the coast. Bay Area highs in the 60s near the water, all the way up to 100 or so well inland today. And that heat advisory in effect also through tomorrow. The Weather Service says it starts to cool off tomorrow. Plan on 80 today in San Francisco, Concord 100, Fairfield 101, San Jose 93 today, 104 in Sacramento.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. At the southern border, things are different this morning. That's because President Biden has signed an executive order that restricts migrants from seeking asylum there and allows officials to temporarily stop processing asylum claims when the number of unauthorized daily crossings surge, as is the case right now.
We must face the simple truth. To protect America as a land that welcomes immigrants, we must first secure the border and secure it now.
That's the president speaking from the White House yesterday alongside lawmakers from border states. And the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, is on the line with us now to tell us more. Mr. Secretary, welcome back to the program. Good morning.
Good morning, Michelle. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming. So why now?
Well, we have been asking and imploring Congress to pass bipartisan legislation now for months. It has had two opportunities to do so, and before the opportunity to pass a very important bipartisan piece of legislation, we also asked Congress and implored Congress to properly fund our department and the other departments that are involved in the administration of our immigration laws. That Senate legislation would have been the most dramatic and toughest change to our border enforcement laws in decades.
I know. So they rejected that a couple of weeks ago. The Republicans walked away from it, allegedly because the former President Trump asked them to do so. So again, why now?
Well, it is our responsibility to deliver for the American people when Congress fails to do so. The executive action that the president has taken is no substitute for legislation, but we will do whatever we can within our legal authorities, and that is precisely what we have done.
To that question, President Biden is using the same part of the law that former President Trump used in 2017 and 2018. Both those efforts were blocked by the courts. The ACLU has already said it's going to challenge the law. Why do you think this plan will survive a similar lawsuit?
Well, this plan is quite different than what the former president issued, Michelle. The former president had no exceptions to the bar on asylum. What we have done is not only established exceptions, for example, unaccompanied children will not be subject to the asylum bar, but very, very importantly, this executive action is taken in the context of all of the lawful pathways that we have built for individuals to lawfully, safely, and in an orderly way apply for asylum and gain the benefit of humanitarian relief in this country, whether it is through our CBP-1 application at the ports of entry that allows 1,400 to 1,500 people each day to access humanitarian relief in the United States, whether it's our parole program for Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans that allows up to 30,000 individuals per month to access our asylum system. This is markedly different than what the prior administration promulgated.
And to that question, why those numbers? And then this new order kicks in, as I understand it, when the 7-day daily average is more than 2,500 people. You and other members of the administration have been complaining for some time now that you just don't have the infrastructure to process sort of this many people. So why that number? How does this fix that?
Michelle, we set the numbers according, really as a proxy for what our capabilities permit based on the resources that we have. We are fundamentally under-resourced as a department, which is why in August of last year, in October of last year, the president submitted a significant supplemental funding bill that Congress failed to act upon, why the bipartisan Senate legislation provided for such robust resources for our department and the Departments of State and Justice. We are perennially underfunded, and we need to be resourced, and our people deserve to be resourced.
And unfortunately, I'm going to have to go back to my first question. Just, I still don't think I've heard an answer here. The presidential election is 5 months away. Immigration is obviously a major concern for voters. What do you say to those who say that they think this is political maneuvering? It's about trying to sort of look tough on immigration to appeal to people who are worried about it.
I would respectfully and vehemently disagree. On day one of his administration, the president presented Congress with comprehensive immigration reform, a piece of legislation that he implored Congress to act upon. Up until May of last year, we were operating under the public health order of Title 42. We drove the numbers down once that Title 42 order was lifted, despite everyone's expectations that pandemonium would ensue. We implored Congress thereafter to fund this department and the immigration system. We then worked on bipartisan legislation. Congress has failed to act as recently as 2 weeks ago, and this executive action was taken. We have been steadfast in our efforts to secure the border within our executive authorities, and we need Congress to fix what everyone agrees is a fundamentally broken immigration system, and only Congress can deliver the enduring solution.
That is the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas. Mr. Secretary, thank you for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michelle.
Listening into that conversation was NPR immigration correspondent Sergio Martinez Beltran, and so we've called him to ask him, Sergio, what stood out to you?
Your questions of why now, right? I mean, that is the question that many people have been asking, especially, Michelle, because we have seen the numbers at the southern border go down. Sure. In December, we saw a record high in terms of unauthorized crossings at that border, but those numbers have plummeted significantly, and they have even bucked these traditional migration trends. The reason for that, we know, is Mexico. Immigration observers say that Mexico has been a key role, has had a key role here. They have enforced our immigration laws at the urging of the U.S. They have deployed their National Guard troops to patrol its borders. It's also repatriating migrants. Now, you know, the numbers are down. We do know that there's also this idea that there are a lot of migrants stuck in Mexico because of these policies. So there might be some concerns that, you know, if there's not a law like this in place, migrants might start coming eventually again. But again, the numbers show that there are less people crossing today than what they were in December.
So let me follow up as briefly as you can. The question I also asked the secretary is, they've been complaining for months, and there's evidence to support that there is not the infrastructure to support the number of people coming. Based on your reporting, does that number seem sustainable to you, the number that they've set as the threshold?
I mean, it is sustainable for the administration. The thing is that it's also a very, very strict threshold, because we do know that there are more than 2,500 people that are crossing daily. And so that would mean that in order to bring that threshold even lower to 1,500 for this provision to be lifted, it's going to be really hard and really challenging.
That is NPR immigration correspondent Sergio Martinez Beltran. Sergio, thank you.
You're welcome.
4 years ago, President Biden overwhelmingly won among Gen Z and millennial voters. And within that group, Black, Latino, and Asian Americans led in their support for him. But now a new Gen Forward poll from the University of Chicago finds that the coalition may be severely diminished. NPR's Alina Moore got an exclusive first look at the new survey. So how does this poll lay out for the state of the race for candidates looking to win over young voters?
Good morning. Yeah, well, the poll focused on Americans under 40, and unlike a lot of surveys, the sample was fairly evenly split by race and ethnicity, so it gave a really detailed snapshot of this group. It found overall that President Biden has a lot of work to do, especially among young Latino and Black Americans. In 2020, Biden won around 80% of Black voters under 45 years old, and in this poll, just 33% said they'd support him, and nearly a quarter are backing Trump. And among Latino young people, Trump is actually winning by a small margin in this poll. 4 years ago, Biden won around 60% of that vote.
Alina, I'm not a math whiz by any means. It doesn't sound like it adds up to 100% of young voters. So where are they looking for alternatives in the Biden-Trump rematch?
Well, the 2024 question included third-party candidates Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Cornel West, along with a someone else option. And we know that regardless of age, third-party candidates have a tendency to draw away votes from the main party nominees. And among young voters who already don't love their options, that is very much the case. That's probably why about a third of respondents overall picked Kennedy, West, or that generic someone else choice. Here's how Kathy Cohen explains it. She's a professor at the University of Chicago who runs the poll.
Young people are saying to Joe Biden, win me, win my vote. Don't assume I'm going to vote for you.
And, you know, Cohen expects that some of that uncertainty could change as the election gets closer. It is June, and, you know, more people start to have the 2024 race on their minds. But for others, dissatisfaction with Biden could end up meaning they vote for someone else or sit it out.
Yeah, so on that dissatisfaction, some younger voters have expressed that by protesting the ongoing Israel-Hamas war, even by voting uncommitted in Democratic primaries. So what issues are driving these voters now?
Well, the poll found that Israel's war in Gaza is not the top issue for most young Americans. That said, it is something they care about. It may not be the top voting issue. A majority of young people do support a permanent ceasefire, and nearly half disapprove of Biden's handling of the conflict. But as for, like I said, that top voting issue, the poll found that it's, once again, the economy, particularly inflation. That said, young people don't think Biden is the best candidate to address it. And notably, even on Biden's handling of other issues that are key to his platform this year, like protecting abortion access, young people don't overwhelmingly trust him.
You've traveled around the country talking with young voters. Does this survey back up what you've heard?
I mean, largely, yes. Young people are focused on the issues, especially the economy. But abortion, immigration, and the war in Gaza, they come up all the time. And more than anything, though, people tell me they're just frustrated, with the candidates and lack of options here.
That's NPR's Alina Moore. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Here on listener-supported KQED at 819, I'm Dave Freeman. Join us for KQED News. Brian Watt coming up shortly at 822. Here's Mel with a look at Dublin traffic right now at 819.
680 southbound at El Costa Boulevard. A Big Rig's tires are in the middle and right lanes. 92 westbound from Industrial Boulevard to Delaware Street across the San Mateo Bridge is still slow. It's slow across the Dumbarton westbound from the high rise to University Avenue, and 880 southbound between Highway 92 and Stevenson Boulevard. That's stop and go traffic. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Another Planet Entertainment, presenting Francis Crabell at Fox Theater this Thursday, June 6th. Tickets on sale now at Ticketmaster.com. VisitorsCoverage.com, offering both inbound U.S. and outbound U.S. travel, medical, and trip insurance, so travelers are covered for financial risks and medical emergencies wherever they go. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com.
Coming up on the California Report, L.A. Dodgers star Shohei Ohtani has faced some scrutiny over the last few months, but that hasn't stopped thousands of Japanese fans from flying in to see the baseball star on his new team. I'm Madi Bolaños. How has this new wave of fans boosted the local economy? We'll find out next time on the California Report.
8:51 a.m. on KQED. Stay tuned for Forum at 9. Forum will discuss the campaign spending of billionaire Miriam Adelson and how it could affect the presidential race. Then at 10.
Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and Count Basie were as much a part of American culture as Coca-Cola and Mickey Mouse, says Larry Tye, author of a new biography of the three men. Known worldwide for their pioneering compositions and arrangements, Armstrong's, Ellington's, and Basie's popularity among white audiences would ultimately lay the foundation for the civil rights movement. Tye's new book is called The Jazz Men. Join Forum at 10 a.m. here on KQED.
Support for NPR comes from Acorn TV, with stories from all around the world in one place. From dramas to mysteries to comedies, Acorn TV offers multiple ways to stream. Subscription options at acorn.tv. You're a part-time controller, U.S.-based staff helping nonprofits with their accounting, from bookkeeping to financial reporting and analysis to CFO services. yptc.com/NPR. And by the FDA, its sunscreen safety campaign is aimed at encouraging people to use broad-spectrum sunscreens with an SPF of 15 or higher to block the sun's harmful rays. More at fda.gov/sunscreen. And the listeners of KQED.
It's Morning Edition on KQED. I'm Brian Watt. Two chickens that were being sold at a market in San Francisco last month had bird flu. Health officials confirmed this to KQED this week. That's as bird flu is spreading to cows on dairy farms across the country. Now, health officials are testing San Francisco's sewage every day to check for it. KQED's senior science editor Kevin Stark reports that so far, at least, the news is promising.
The two infected chickens did not show any symptoms, but California food safety regulators discovered them with a routine PCR test. Dr. George Hahn directs one of San Francisco's disease prevention programs.
The first important thing to understand is that there have been no human cases in San Francisco or elsewhere in California.
He also says the public was not exposed and market employees did not report symptoms.
Did repeat testing, etc., just to make sure that there was no additional positive detections.
After the positive test results, researchers took to the sewers to determine whether it had spread. They did find bird flu material in frozen samples pulled from the city's sewage system. However, they've tested the wastewater stream every day since with no hits and haven't had any others in California.
This seems to have been like a temporarily confined event associated with perhaps these birds being in the market there.
Stanford's Ali Baum leads the wastewater surveillance project, which monitors for bird flu around the country. She says this work builds on a pandemic-era playbook for monitoring wastewater for COVID-19. It's also the first time researchers have tested specifically for bird flu in wastewater.
We're really viewing these measurements in wastewater to be a new tool for trying to better understand the extent and duration of the H5N1 outbreak.
Baum's team has found evidence of bird flu at more than a dozen locations around the U.S.
Other than that, all the samples have been negative, which is good news.
especially for California's dairy industry, which is the largest in the country, and so far hasn't had a cow test positive. I'm Kevin Stark, KQED News.
Several bills that would regulate autonomous vehicles in California are making their way through the state legislature. In recent years, the two major companies operating driverless cars here in San Francisco, Waymo and Cruise, have faced heavy criticism over road safety. A new investigation by the Bay Area's NBC affiliate raises questions about the ability of autonomous vehicles to recognize and avoid people in crosswalks, an experience shared by many school crossing guards. For more, we're joined by Begad Shaban, senior investigative reporter with NBC Bay Area. Hello.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So, for this report, Begad, you spoke with many school crossing guards themselves. So what is going on?
We did. So we spoke with 30 crossing guards, Brian, stationed across more than 20 schools across San Francisco. And what we found is that nearly one in four, so we're talking about 25%, told us they experienced some type of close call in the crosswalk, where either the Waymo driverless vehicle had to brake suddenly to avoid hitting the crossing guard, or the crossing guard had to physically rush out of the crosswalk to avoid being hit. And what we were struck by is just how eerily similar the stories were that we heard from these crossing guards, all saying that this happened with a Waymo driverless car. We spoke with Teresa Dorn. She has seen it all when it comes to being a crossing guard. She's been at that corner for more than a decade near Flynn Elementary School in the Bernal Heights neighborhood in San Francisco. And she tells us over the past year, she was actually nearly hit by a Waymo driverless car three different times.
The parent grabbed the child and looked at the car. And there was nobody driving it, so, you know, they just, like, grabbed their chest.
It almost hit you.
Yes. It did not recognize me in the intersection.
Wow. Okay, so when you reached out to Waymo about all of this, what did the company tell you?
They say that, frankly, they are proud of their safety record, but they say they also recognize the importance of, quote, ensuring that other road users feel confident and comfortable around their technology. They say they want to be a good member of the community. But it's important to note that one of the questions that we asked these crossing guards is the date and time of the incident, because we, and obviously Waymo, full well know that their vehicles are equipped with cameras. And so basically they can go back and actually see what their cars may or may not have done. But without having that information, it is difficult to be able to go back and see what their cars may or may not have done, because the crossing guards just don't remember exactly the date or time that it happened. And we also asked if they filed police reports, and none say that they did.
So I imagine that the state would have a difficult time tracking these sorts of near misses by school crossing guards.
Well, and that's part of the contention, is that really to date, the only kind of reporting that driverless cars are largely required to do has to do with actual collisions. But as you might imagine, there is certainly a push to change that. We actually sat down with California Representative Kevin Mullen, who talked about what he sees as the importance of essentially tracking what he describes as these near misses.
Those kinds of incidents where people's lives are put at risk, but it's not reportable now, we need to be looking at those.
Driverless cars are still pretty limited across the state. Waymo has approval to operate in parts of the peninsula and is already operating further down in Los Angeles. But how are lawmakers thinking about this growth as they try to regulate their activity legislatively?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, whether people are for it or against it, I think both sides appreciate it's not a matter of if, but when. The goal is to become this robust transportation network, similar to what you might see with current ride-hailing programs like Uber and Lyft, except there's not going to be anyone behind the wheel. So I think as we continue to sort of navigate some of these safety issues, certainly opponents are going to argue that this is a must. These are speed bumps that we need to be able to navigate if we are to see this kind of transportation system expand into the monstrosity that I think a lot of these transportation companies hope to see it in the near future.
Begad Shaban, senior investigative reporter with NBC Bay Area. Hey, thank you.
Brian, thanks.
You're listening to Morning Edition on KQED.
More news on the way in a minute. Let's check in with Mel and get the latest traffic right now.
In San Jose, 880 southbound, just after Stevens Creek Boulevard, a vehicle door is in the right lane. Jumping up to El Cerrito in the East Bay, 80 eastbound before Potrero Avenue, the two right lanes are blocked by an accident. Seeing some real slowing on westbound 80, it's stop and go, mostly stop, from Hilltop Drive all the way down to University Avenue in Berkeley. The backup on the Bay Bridge just a bit past the overcrossing. Mel Baker. For KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Broadway SF, presenting Company, the Tony-winning best revival of a musical that reimagines one of Stephen Sondheim's most beloved works, at the Orpheum Theater now through June 29th. Tickets at BroadwaySF.com. Sunny, warm to hot Bay Area. Look for a beach hazard statement along the coast with high surf today. Highs in the 70s to around 100 inland. It's 8:30.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. After two failed attempts, Boeing Starliner has blasted off from Florida. Two astronauts are on board the commercially built capsule that was strapped to an Atlas V rocket. Sunita Suni Williams and Barry Butch Wilmore are bound for the International Space Station, where they will spend about a week. If the mission goes as planned, NASA is expected to certify Starliner as a second means of routinely launching astronauts to ISS. Since 2020, SpaceX has been NASA's only ride from U.S. soil. President Biden is in Europe for D-Day's 80th anniversary. This may be the last for many World War II veterans who are in their late 90s or over 100 years old. NPR's Tamara Keefe says Biden's pilgrimage to Normandy this week evokes longstanding differences between him and his predecessor this election year.
With President Biden extolling the importance of these alliances and former President Donald Trump borrowing a pre-World War II slogan of America First and repeatedly toying with the idea of the U.S. not keeping its commitment to NATO.
That's Tamara Keefe reporting. Former President Donald Trump is airing his grievances on Newsmax about his recent criminal conviction. He says his rivals set a terrible precedent. Trump was convicted by 12 jurors in a case involving hush money payments. Meanwhile, in Delaware, witness testimony continues today for President Biden's son Hunter Biden's firearms trial. From Washington, this is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt in San Francisco. San Mateo County leaders are vowing to rebuild an affordable housing complex under construction near Redwood City, which burned down on Monday. KQED's Vanessa Roncagno reports.
San Mateo County needs to build more than 1,200 units of affordable housing in the next few years to meet the expected demand. The 179 apartments in the destroyed building would have helped close that gap. Board of Supervisors President Warren Slocum represents the district where the complex is located. He says the project was 10 years in the making.
It's just a devastating loss in terms of affordable units. We're all committed to rebuilding. We're not just going to walk away from it.
Slocum says insurance should cover much of the cost of rebuilding, and the county will likely seek state and federal funds to make up the difference. I'm Vanessa Rancagno, KQED News.
The latest batch of votes in Berkeley's election for the vacant city council seat in District 4 show Igor Tregub ahead with 51% and Ruben Hernandez Story with 49%. All other candidates have been eliminated in the ranked choice voting process. Although the figures aren't official and there may still be some ballots left to count, Tregub declared victory on Tuesday. In a statement, he thanked supporters and opponents and said, quote, "Elections come and go. Community is what we build in between." The special election was called after Kate Harrison abruptly resigned her seat in January. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. And support for KQED comes from UCSF Health. To love San Francisco is to not only embrace its diversity, but celebrate it. That's why UCSF Health provides care designed for the unique needs of each patient. To learn more, visit ucsfhealth.org/withlove. The producers, reporters, and hosts of KQED Public Radio are represented by the Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, AFL-CIO. Coming up, antibiotics work against bacterial infections, not viruses. Yet during the pandemic, many COVID patients were given such drugs. This has led to a lasting increase in antibiotic-resistant infections. One of the stories ahead this morning. Support for NPR comes from Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. And Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And by the listeners and members of KQED Public Radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has won a third term in office, but his party, while winning the most seats in the Indian Parliament, did not secure the majority they were hoping for and, according to the polls, expected. Modi will now need to work with an opposition that does not support his Hindu nationalist ideology. For a view about what happened and what it means, we've called political analyst Nirlanjan Sarkar. He is with the Center for Policy Research in Delhi. That's an independent, nonpartisan think tank. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So as we said, Modi's party won far less seats than expected. What do you make of that?
So, the last two national elections, the BJP, led by Narendra Modi, the Bharatiya Janata Party is the full name of the party, has had extraordinary electoral outcomes, numbers that we hadn't seen in 30, 40 years. 282 seats in 2014, 303 seats in 2019. 272 is the majority mark. And so we all sort of imagined that the BJP, led by Narendra Modi, would see those kinds of numbers again. Mm-hmm. But actually, they fell to around 240 seats by themselves. They are going to require coalition partners in order to form government, and that's sort of the discussion that is underway today.
So, I think we're familiar here in the U.S. with the way that Modi has cracked down on any public criticism of his leadership. I am curious if you think that that approach contributed to the results that we saw?
I think it definitely did. In the lead up to the election, we saw two standing chief ministers arrested. We saw the main opposition party, the Congress Party, have its accounts frozen. And we saw a lot of bullying of political opposition. In fact, so much so that many were obliged to defect to the BJP, to the Bharatiya Janata Party, in order to survive. And so we do think that the voters in various ways did punish the BJP for that. In certain places, people would say things like, we need to defend the Constitution. In other places, they would be concerned about leaders coming from other parties into the BJP. In other places, they would say, we need to save federalism. But all of it sort of boiled down to the same source, the idea that a government had crossed red lines when it came to certain democratic norms.
So where do you think this, so as we said, that he will now have to govern in coalition, which is something that has been part of India's past, but not under Modi, who has, as you've just told us, has substantially sort of consolidated sort of power. What does this mean going forward? Like, where in his policies might we see the difference going forward?
So it's really an unknown unknown. Prime Minister Modi, his calling card, his model of governance is predicated on political centralization. He was the chief minister of the state of Gujarat for many years before he became the prime minister, and he also governed in this fashion when he was the chief minister of the state. So he's never had to compromise. My take is that he's going to continue to try to centralize power and try to figure out ways of coercing his coalition partners, even though he doesn't have a single party majority himself. But it's an unknown unknown. How well will it work? Will the coalition partners take it? Will the coalition partners push back? I think we're in for a particularly stormy beginning to the coalition government, because this is a leadership that has never had to deal with coalition governance, not at the state level and not at the national level.
And do you have a sense of what expectations people in India have for this new coalition government? And if you have time, we'd love to know how these results might affect India's foreign policy, specifically its relationship with the U.S. and China.
So, I think that the average person has been happy with many parts of Prime Minister Modi's policies, particularly cash transfers, welfare delivery. Many of these things have been fine infrastructure. But the crossing of certain red lines, the using of state agencies, that's really a line that hasn't been crossed, that shouldn't have been crossed. Very quickly on foreign policy, I think you will continue to see a muscular foreign policy that India has shown towards the U.S. and China. You won't really see the coalition partners moderate that very much.
That is Niranjan Sarkar, a senior fellow at the Center for Policy Research in Delhi. That's an independent nonpartisan think tank. Mr. Sarkar, thanks so much for sharing these insights with us.
Thank you for having me.
Antibiotics don't treat or cure COVID. They don't help, and yet during the pandemic, COVID patients were given a lot of them. New research shows that overuse of antibiotics has had a lasting impact on superbugs in hospitals. Here's NPR's Gabriella Emanuel.
Antibiotics work against bacterial infections, not against viral infections like COVID. But at the height of the pandemic, doctors in many countries prescribed those antibiotics anyway, just in case it would help.
In the beginning of the pandemic, we were very concerned that a bacteria would set up shop on top of the viral pneumonia caused by COVID. And because of that, we overused antibiotics.
Helen Boucher is dean of Tufts University School of Medicine and studies antimicrobial resistance.
At the same time, the people who helped to ensure that we use antibiotics the most appropriately were called away from their jobs to focus on caring for COVID patients.
Now the results are in. New data from the World Health Organization show that globally, about 75% of patients hospitalized with COVID were given antibiotics, despite the fact that only 8% had a bacterial co-infection where antibiotics might have been useful.
It's sobering to see these data.
Overusing antibiotics is a problem because it gives bacteria more opportunities to develop resistance to medications. So-called superbugs kill more than a million people every year. When Boucher became a doctor some 30 years ago, she says it was unheard of in the U.S. to see a patient die of a drug-resistant infection. No longer.
We now live in a world where I have to see patients for whom I have nothing to offer. I've had to send people home on hospice because we don't have an antibiotic to treat their infection.
The problem got even worse during the pandemic. Superbug infections in hospitals shot up more than 30%. And now preliminary data from the National Institutes of Health show that even as the pandemic fades, antibiotic-resistant infections remain stubbornly elevated. They are about 12% above pre-pandemic levels. Samir Kadri is an epidemiologist at the NIH. He worked on these data. He says scientists need to figure out why the pandemic is having this lingering effect.
Is it higher antibiotic use? Is it changes in infection control practices and policies?
Is it continued medical staff shortages?
We're not back to our baseline. And I think to consider this status quo as a new normal is a colossal mistake.
Kadri says patients' lives are on the line if the world can't rein in the superbugs that were unleashed in the pandemic. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Traffic now in Pittsburgh on KQED with Mel Baker.
Still stop and go. Highway 4 westbound between Railroad Avenue and Willow Pass Road. 680 southbound between 242 and Ignacio Valley Road. Stop and go. And 680 southbound in the Snow Gray just after Andrade. An accident is blocking one of the middle lanes. Mel Baker for KQED.
It's time now for a KQED perspective at 8:43. Making a new friend at a senior home gave listener Arya Kononur a new perspective on a life well lived.
Last September, my friend and I were searching for opportunities in our community to earn volunteer hours. We walked into a senior home right across our street asking if we could help. They jumped at the offer and said it had been a long time since anyone had offered their time. A month after I started volunteering, a new resident came in who I'll call John. He had recently gone into a coma and woken up fully blind. Bored and stuck in the confines of the home, he asked the staff if anyone could take him for regular walks. Perfect timing. My friend and I began taking turns to walk John around the building. And during our walks, he talked about his life and experiences. Several things stuck with me. Firstly, he demonstrated the importance of good relationships. He and his wife called their family every day since moving into the home, and their family visits every week. John says that's one of the reasons he's always happy. He has solid relationships. He even has friends caring for his old motorcycle from 60 years ago. Secondly, he taught me the importance of acceptance. At the beginning of this year, John's wife unfortunately passed away. And as devastated as he was, he understood that death is inevitable. He said, many people hold on to their life and fight death for their loved ones, knowing that they can't fight for long. He didn't want her to go through that, and he let her go. He missed her, but didn't want to see her suffer. Thirdly, he showed me the value of time. He said, we're lucky to be among the 8 billion people who are alive now, and we should make the best of that. Hence, I waste less time and dedicate more effort toward my passions. John says he doesn't mind being blind so much now because he's already done everything he wanted to do. And to me, that's the ultimate achievement in life, to look back on it when I'm older and say, I'm satisfied with this. With the perspective, I'm Arya Kununur.
Arya Kununur is an incoming high school freshman in San Jose who enjoys writing, producing electronic music, playing the guitar, and running track in school. Support for Perspectives comes from Comcast, dedicated to serving California communities by offering digital equity initiatives and providing financial donations to help families and seniors get online and participate in the digital economy. More at california.comcast.com. Hot inland today while cooler at the immediate coast. Weather Service says a heat advisory still in effect for most of the inland areas of the Bay Area and the Sacramento Valley through tomorrow. Temperatures will moderate towards the end of the week. Bay Area highs today, 70s and 80s. Coast and Bay up to 100 well inland today. Heat advisory ends tomorrow evening. Excessive heat warning for the Sacramento Valley with highs 100 to 105 today. Clear tonight, overnight lows 62 to 72. Slowly cooling tomorrow, still hot however. Tomorrow's predicted high, Sacramento Valley, 95 to 105 degrees. Support for NPR comes from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing a transformative approach to justice that is community-led, restorative, and racially just. Learn more at publicwelfare.org. The Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And the listeners and members of KQED.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The risks of traumatic brain injury in football are well known, but researchers have found that equestrian sports are a leading cause of this type of concussion in U.S. sports. Riding accidents can also be fatal. Last month, a British rider died during an eventing competition in England. Eventing is like an equestrian triathlon made up of three different disciplines, dressage, show jumping, and cross country. For more on the risks of this kind of sport, I spoke with John Holling. He's the U.S. Safety Officer for the International Federation of Equestrian Sports.
The big meat of eventing is the cross-country phase. It's the phase where you're galloping out in the field, over solid fences, jumping into water, over ditches. It's very natural. It's pretty high adrenaline and really exciting.
Now, what makes equestrian sports overall a higher risk of traumatic brain injuries?
There's probably no greater risk in equestrian sport that something's going to go wrong as there is in any other sport. It's just that when it does, you don't have a 300-pound lineman that's going to fall on you. You have a 1,200-pound horse. So that cost can be a bit higher.
What are some of the worst falls that either you've experienced or seen?
For myself personally, I've had a young horse at home get away from me when I was training it as a baby, and it got away from me while I was on it and slipped and fell and I broke my leg. I had to have a couple surgeries. I have 4 screws in my leg still. So that's probably the worst one that I've had, which to be fair, I consider myself pretty lucky, but I've broken both legs, both arms doing horses. It is part of the deal when you do this for a lifetime. It is a high risk sport, but I think it's a really important thing that when you do have one of those rare, unfortunate moments, that the sport and a panel of experts evaluates that and looks at it rationally and decides, okay, did we have everything right and this was just an unfortunate moment, or we could have improved it here, there, or somewhere else?
Is there anything, John, that you can think of, any changes that have been made in the sport to try and reduce the risk of injury as much as possible?
I'd say the biggest thing that's happened is the introduction of frangible fences. We're talking about things like an aluminum pin that if there's enough force on it, the fence will break. So that, yes, the rider and the horse get a penalty. They might even have the rider become unseated, but you're minimizing the risk of a tragic fall. It's been a game changer. Since 2012, we've improved the statistics for rotational falls by 55.5%. It is significantly improving things, but I think at the same point, we need to be aware that if you're riding a horse and you're galloping at speed at solid fences, it's still a risky, high-risk sport.
So, John, when people watch eventing at the Olympics in Paris this summer, what are some of the things that you want them to keep in mind about both of the athletes on the screen, both the horse and the rider?
I think the big thing I want them to do is to appreciate that they're watching the best, most qualified people from their countries compete. They have spent years getting to that moment. And with that in mind, enjoy it. It is cool. It is the truest test of horsemanship and athletic ability that you will see at the Olympics. And it's just going to be an incredible day of sport.
That's three-day eventing rider John Holling, National Safety Officer for the U.S. to the International Equestrian Federation. John, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
Let's find out how the horseless carriages are moving along in Santa Rosa.
Not so well. Highway 12 westbound at Merced Avenue. Traffic is stop and go back to Fulton Road. A dump truck and pickup truck involved in a crash. 101 northbound, beginning around Yolando Avenue through the 12 interchange up to College Avenue, is still slow. And it's really stop and go on 101 southbound in Novato from Highway 37 down to Central San Rafael. Mel Baker. For KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Style Bath and Kitchen, providing design knowledge on how to pick the right kitchen faucet, cabinets, bathroom, shower, or bathtub, and more in their new video series, available on their website by searching Style Bath and Kitchen online. And the San Mateo County Fair. Fairgoers can learn about the origins of toys at the Toytopia exhibit. And as always, there's farm animals, butterfly exhibit, and pig races. June 1st through the 9th, tickets at sanmateocountyfair.com. Hot again today around the bay near the water, 70s all the way up to the low 100s, well inland. It's 8:51.
Good morning. This is the California Report. I'm Maddie Bolaños in San Francisco, and here are some of the state stories we're following. Santa Clara County Sheriff's officials say officers have detained about a dozen pro-Palestinian activists who barricaded themselves inside the Stanford president's office this morning. The group called Stanford for Palestine wants the university's board of trustees to consider a proposal to divest from companies tied to Israel's military's assault on Gaza, and they want the school's president to support the bill. Stanford student Emily Williams speaks for the group.
They believe that Stanford has not acted in good faith or moved in the direction of divestment. And so their demands still remain the same, which are divestment from companies that are materially and or monetarily contributing to or working with the Zionist Israeli entity.
The protesters were in the building for about 2 hours before police broke in and escorted them out. Among those detained is a reporter with a Stanford Daily, according to the student-run news outlet. A Stanford representative describes the actions of the protesters as unlawful. Early indications are that a controversial school board president in Temecula will be recalled. Although votes are still being counted, the effort to recall Joseph Komorowski is winning by a 54-46% margin. Madison Ament with KVCR in San Bernardino reports.
Joseph Komorowski was elected in 2022 along with two other candidates, all backed by a conservative Christian PAC. Under Komorowski, they pushed policies to ban critical race theory and force schools to notify parents if their child is transgender. They also sparred with Governor Gavin Newsom over social studies curriculum because it mentions gay civil rights leader Harvey Milk. Komorowski's opponents, who pushed the recall, like Julie Geary, also don't like how he runs the meetings. Geary was at a watch party last night and says regardless of the outcome,
it was worth it.
It was worth it for the students of Temecula. It was worth it for the teachers.
Komrosky did not respond to a request for comment. All along, he said he's done exactly what voters elected him to do. If Komrosky is recalled, the board can either appoint a new member or hold a special election. For the California Report, I'm Madison Ahmet.
Support for the California Report comes from Hint. Fruit-infused water with no sugar or diet sweeteners with more than 25 flavors, including watermelon and pineapple. In stores or delivered from hintwater.com. Monterey Bay Aquarium, inspiring conservation of the ocean through amazing live exhibits and global action to protect the ocean from plastic pollution, climate change, and overfishing. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy includes Schmidt Ocean Institute, advancing the frontiers of ocean science, exploration, and discovery, on the web at schmidtocean.org.
LA's tourism industry, still trying to rebound from the pandemic, has gotten a gift in the form of Shohei Ohtani. Japanese fans have come by the thousands to see the superstar play for his new team, the Dodgers. LAist Josie Wong says they're also exploring different corners of the city.
In Japan, one of the morning shows reported on all the Ohtani fans flying into LA. Cut to shots of the Hollywood sign, the beach, and also Little Tokyo. Despite the name, Little Tokyo is not widely known in Japan, but that's changing. Not only is the neighborhood located near Dodger Stadium, go there and you'll see a new 15-story mural of Ohtani covering a side of the Miyako Hotel. Inside the hotel, employees are selling Japanese-style pastries shaped like blue Dodger helmets and getting to practice their Japanese. Over in the lobby, Megu Adachi is checking in with several other friends from Japan. They have tickets to watch Ohtani play, or as Adachi fondly calls him,
Yakyu Shonen.
Yakyu Shonen, a boy obsessed with baseball.
Baseball only.
Hotel manager Akira Yuhara says when the Dodgers are playing at home, half the rooms are occupied by Japanese tourists in town to see Ohtani. He says they had little reason to visit Little Tokyo before, it being downtown and seen by some as
very dangerous here, especially this area, they don't want to come.
Yuhara says a sister hotel he manages in Torrance is more popular with Japanese travelers. The South Bay is where SoCal's Japanese-American Population Center shifted to from Little Tokyo after World War II. Scores of Japanese companies like Honda and All Nippon Airways have operations there, and it's where many of their employees live, eat, bank, and shop. But Yuhara, the hotel manager, says Ohtani has revived interest in what's happening up the 110.
Even we don't have a game today, they go to Dodger Stadium and buy everything.
At the stadium, visitors can pick up Ohtani's number 17 jersey. Concession stands sell chicken katsu sandwiches and fried octopus. Signs and kanji characters dot the stadium, where tours are now given in Japanese several times a week.
We can refer to it as the Ohtani effect.
Adam Burke, president and CEO of LA's Tourism Board, projects tourism from Japan could exceed pre-pandemic levels.
I don't think it's beyond the pale that we could be over 400,000 Japanese visitors, and that would absolutely make it one of our top four international markets.
Likely alongside markets such as China and the UK. Leading Japanese tour operator JTB alone plans to bring as many as 25,000 travelers to see Shohei this season. Osuke Ishiguro manages the agency's LA office. He says even though the yen is weak right now, visitors are paying to see
just not the one game, but like three games in a row, they're coming out to see.
His agency is booking customers in and around Little Tokyo. He says not since another Japanese superstar, Hideo Nomo, played for the Dodgers more than two decades ago, have this many Japanese tourists regularly flocked to this part of town. Outside the Miyako Hotel, Tadashi Onaka is visiting the Ohtani mural. He had planned a trip to Arizona to visit family, but took a detour to LA so he could go to a Dodgers game. He recalls how Ohtani smacked a single in the first inning. Now he finds himself in Little Tokyo, a place he's surprised to learn has been around for 140 years. Very small, he adds. And very different from Japan. Rather, it's its own thing that now legions of Ohtani fans are starting to discover. For the California Report, I'm Josie Huang in LA.
And that is the California Report for Wednesday, June 5th. We're a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Mavi Bolaños. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Stay tuned.